The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 9 of Sir Nigel. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 9. How Nigel held the bridge at Tilford. The king looked at the motionless figure, at the little crowd of hushed, expectant rustics beyond the bridge, and finally at the face of Chandos, which shone with amusement. "What is this, John?" he asked.
"You remember Sir Eustace Loring, sire?"
"Indeed, I could never forget him, nor the manner of his death."
"He was a knight errant in his day."
"That indeed he was. None better have I known."
"So is his son Nigel, as fierce a young warhawk as ever yearned to use beak and claws, but held fast in the mews up to now. This is his trial fight. There he stands at the bridgehead, as was wont in our father's time, ready to measure himself against all comers."
Of all Englishmen there was no greater knight-errant than the king himself, and none so steeped in every quaint usage of chivalry, so that the situation was after his own heart. "He is not yet a knight?"
"No, sire, only a squire."
"Then he must bear himself bravely this day, if he is to make good what he has done. Is it fitting that a young, untried squire should venture to couch his lance against the best of England?"
"He hath given me his cartel and challenge," said Chandos, drawing a paper from his tunic. "Have I your permission, sire, to issue it?"
"Surely, John, we have no cavalier more versed in the laws of chivalry than yourself. You know this young man, and you are aware how far he is worthy of the high honor which he asks. Let us hear his defiance." The knights and squires of the escort, most of whom were veterans of the French war, had been gazing with interest and some surprise at the steel-clad figure in front of them. Now, at a call from Sir Walter Manny, they assembled round the spot where the king and Chandos had halted. Chandos cleared his throat and read from his paper.
"A tous seigneurs, chevaliers et escuyers." "So it is headed, gentlemen. It is a message from the good Squire Nigel Loring of Tilford, son of Sir Eustace Loring, of honorable memory. Squire Loring awaits you in arms, gentlemen, yonder upon the crown of the old bridge. Thus says he: For the great desire that I, a most humble and unworthy squire, entertain, that I may come to the knowledge of the noble gentlemen who ride with my royal master, I now wait on the bridge of the way in the hope that some of them may condescend to do some small deed of arms upon me, or that I may deliver them from any vow which they may have taken. This I say out of no esteem for myself, but solely that I may witness the noble bearing of these famous cavaliers and admire their skill in the handling of arms. Therefore, with the help of St. George, I will hold the bridge with sharpened lances against any or all who may deign to present themselves while daylight lasts."
"What say you to this, gentlemen?" asked the king, looking round with laughing eyes.
"Truly it is issued in very good form," said the prince. "Neither Claricieux nor Red Dragon nor any herald that ever wore tabard could better it. Did he draw it of his own hand?"
"He hath a grim old grandmother, who is one of the ancient breed," said Chandos. "I doubt not that the Dame Ermyntrude hath drawn a challenge or two before now. But hark ye, sire, I would have a word in your ear, and yours too, most noble prince."
Leading them aside, Chandos whispered some explanations, which ended by them all three bursting into a shout of laughter.
"By the rood, no honorable gentleman should be reduced to such straits," said the king. "It behooves me to look into it. But how now, gentlemen? This worthy cavalier still waits his answer."
The soldiers had all been buzzing together, but now Walter Manny turned to the king with the result of their counsel. "If it please your majesty," said he, "we are of the opinion that this squire hath exceeded all bounds in desiring to break a spear with a belted knight ere he has given his proofs. We do him sufficient honor if a squire ride against him, and with your consent I have chosen my own body squire, John Widdicombe, to clear the path for us across the bridge."
"What you say, Walter, is right and fair," said the king. "Master Chandos, you will tell our champion yonder what hath been arranged. You will advise him also that it is our royal will that the contest be not fought upon the bridge, since it is very clear that it must end in one or both going over into the river, but that he advance to the end of the bridge and fight upon the plain. You will tell him also that a blunted lance is sufficient for such an encounter, but that a handstroke or two with a sword or mace may well be exchanged if both riders should keep their saddles. A blast upon Raoul's horn shall be the signal to close."
Such ventures as these, where an aspirant for fame would wait for days at a crossroad, a ford, or a bridge, until some worthy antagonist should ride that way, were very common in the old days of adventurous knight-errantry, and were still familiar to the minds of the men, because the stories of the romancers and the songs of the trouvères were full of such incidents. Their actual occurrence, however, had become rare. There was the more curiosity, not unmixed with amusement, in the thoughts of the courtiers as they watched Chandos ride down to the bridge and commented upon the somewhat singular figure of the challenger. His build was strange, and so also was his figure, for the limbs were short for so tall a man. His head was also sunk forward, as if he were lost in thought or overcome with deep dejection. "This is surely the cavalier of the heavy heart," said Manny. "What trouble has he that he should hang his head?"
"Perchance he hath a weak neck," said the king.
"At least he hath no weak voice," the prince remarked, as Nigel's answer to Chandos came to their ears. "By our lady, he booms like a bittern!" As Chandos rode back again to the king, Nigel exchanged the old ash spear, which had been his father's, for one of the blunted tournament lances, which he took from the hands of a stout archer in attendance. He then rode down to the end of the bridge, where a 100-yard stretch of greensward lay in front of him. At the same moment the squire of Sir Walter Manny, who had been hastily armed by his comrades, spurred forward and took up his position. The king raised his hand, there was a clang from the falconer's horn, and the two riders, with a thrust of their heels and a shake of their bridles, dashed furiously at each other. In the centre, the green strip of marshy meadowland, with the water squirting from the galloping hoofs, and the two crouching men gleaming bright in the evening sun. On the one side, the half-circle of motionless horsemen, some in steel, some in velvet, silent and attentive, dogs, hawks, and horses all turned to stone. On the other, the old peaked bridge, the blue lazy river, the group of open-mouthed rustics, and the old dark manor-house, with one grim face which peered from the upper window. A good man was John Widdicombe, but he had met a better that day. Before that yellow whirlwind of a horse, and the rider who was welded and riveted to his saddle, his knees could not hold their grip. Nigel and Pommers were one flying missile, with all their weight and strength and energy centred on the steady end of the lance. Had Widdicombe been struck by a thunderbolt, he could not have flown faster or farther from his saddle. Two full somersaults did he make, his plates clanging like cymbals, ere he lay prone upon his back. For a moment the king looked grave at that prodigious fall. Then, smiling once more as Widdicombe staggered to his feet, he clapped his hands loudly in applause. "A fair course and fairly run!" he cried. "The five scarlet roses bear themselves in peace, even as I have seen them in war. How now, my good Walter? Have you another squire, or will you clear a path for us yourself?" Manny's choleric face had turned darker as he observed the mischance of his representative. He beckoned now to a tall knight, whose gaunt and savage face looked out from his open bassinet as an eagle might from a cage of steel. "Sir Hubert," said he, "I bear in mind the day when you overbore the Frenchman at Caen. Will you not be our champion now?"
"When I fought the Frenchman, Walter, it was with naked weapons," said the knight sternly. "I am a soldier, and I love a soldier's work, but I care not for these tilt-yard tricks, which were invented for nothing but to tickle the fancies of foolish women.
"Oh, most ungallant speech!" cried the King. "Had my good consort heard you, she would have arraigned you to appear at a court of love with a jury of virgins to answer for your sins. But I pray you to take a tilting spear, good Sir Hubert." "I had as soon take a peacock's feather, my fair lord, but I will do it if you ask me. Here, page, hand me one of those sticks, and let me see what I can do."
But Sir Hubert de Burgh was not destined to test either his skill or his luck. The great bay horse which he rode was as unused to this warlike play as was its master, and had none of its master's stoutness of heart. So that when it saw the levelled lance, the gleaming figure, and the frenzied yellow horse rushing down upon it, it swerved, turned, and galloped furiously down the river bank. Amid roars of laughter from the rustics on the one side and from the courtiers on the other, Sir Hubert was seen tugging vainly at his bridle and bounding onward, clearing gorse bushes and heather clumps, until he was but a shimmering, quivering gleam upon the dark hillside. Nigel, who had pulled Pommers onto his very haunches at the instant that his opponent turned, saluted with his lance and trotted back to the bridgehead, where he awaited his next assailant.
"Ooh, the ladies would say that a judgment hath fallen upon our good Sir Hubert for his impious words," said the King.
"Let us hope that his charger may be broken in ere they venture to ride out between two armies," remarked the Prince. "They might mistake the hardness of his horse's mouth for a softness of the rider's heart.
See where he rides, still clearing every bush upon his path."
"By the rood," said the King, "if the bold Hubert has not increased his repute as a jouster, he has gained a great honor as a horseman. But the bridge is still closed, Walter. How say you now? Is this young squire never to be unhorsed? Or is your king himself to lay lance in rest ere his way can be cleared? By the head of St. Thomas, I am in the very mood to run a course with this gentle youth."
"Nay, nay, sire. Too much honor hath already been done him," said Manny, looking angrily at the motionless horseman. "That this untried boy should be able to say that in one evening he has unhorsed my squire and seen the back of one of the bravest knights in England is surely enough to turn his foolish head. Fetch me a spear, Robert. I will see what I can make of him." The famous knight took the spear when it was brought to him as a master workman takes a tool. He balanced it, shook it once or twice in the air, ran his eyes down it for a flaw in the wood, and then, finally having made sure of its poise and weight, laid it carefully in rest under his arm. Then, gathering up his bridle so as to have his horse under perfect command, and covering himself with the shield which was slung round his neck, he rode out to do battle. Now, Nigel, young and experienced, all nature's aid will not help you against the mixed craft and strength of such a warrior. The day will come when neither Manny nor even Chandos could sweep you from your saddle. But now, even had you some less cumbrous armor, your chance was small. Your downfall is near, but as you see the famous black chevrons on a golden ground, your gallant heart, which never knew fear, is only filled with joy and amazement at the honor done you. Your downfall is near, and yet in your wildest dreams you would never guess how strange your downfall is to be. Again, with a dull thunder of hoofs, the horses gallop over the soft water meadow. Again, with a clash of metal, the two riders meet. It is Nigel now, taken clean in the face of his helmet with a blunted spear, who flies backward off his horse and falls clanging on the grass. But good heavens, what is this? Manny has thrown up his hands in horror, and the lance has dropped from his nerveless fingers. From all sides, with cries of dismay, with oaths and shouts and ejaculations to the saints, the horsemen ride wildly in. Was ever so dreadful, so sudden, so complete an end to a gentle passage at arms? Surely their eyes must be at fault. Some wizard's trick had been played upon them to deceive their senses, but no, it was only too clear. There on the greensward lay the trunk of the stricken cavalier, and there, a good dozen yards beyond, lay his helmeted head. "By the Virgin!" cried Manny wildly, as he jumped from his horse. "I would give my last gold piece that the work of this evening should be undone. How came it? What does it mean? Hither, my lord bishop, for surely it smacks of witchcraft and the devil." With a white face, the bishop had sprung down beside the prostrate body, pushing through the knot of horrified knights and squires. "I fear that the last officers of the Holy Church come too late," said he, in a quivering voice. "Most unfortunate young man! How sudden an end!
in medio vitae, as the Holy Book has it. One moment in the pride of his youth, the next his head torn from his body. Now God and the saints have mercy upon me, and guard me from evil!" The last prayer was shot out of the bishop with an energy and earnestness unusual in his horizons. It was caused by the sudden outcry of one of the squires, who, having lifted the helmet from the ground, cast it down again with a scream of horror. "It is empty!" he cried. "It weighs as light as a feather!" "'Fore God, it is true!" cried Manny, laying his hand on it. "There is no one in it!" "With what have I fought, Father Bishop? Is it of this world or the next?"
The bishop had clambered on his horse, the better to consider the point. "If the foul fiend is abroad," said he, "my place is over yonder by the king's side.
Certes, that sulphur-colored horse hath a very devilish look. I could have sworn that I saw both smoke and flame from its nostrils. The beast is fit to bear a suit of armor which rides and fights, and yet hath no man within it."
"Nay, not too fast, Father Bishop," said one of the knights. "It may be all that you say, and yet come from a human workshop. When I made a campaign in South Germany, I have seen at Nuremberg a cunning figure devised by an armorer which could both ride and wield a sword. If this be such a one—"
"I thank you all for your very gentle courtesy,"
said a booming voice from the figure upon the ground. At the words, even the valiant Manny sprang into his saddle. Some rode madly away from the horrid trunk. A few of the boldest lingered.
"Most of all," said the voice, "would I thank the most noble knight, Sir Walter Manny, that he should deign to lay aside his greatness and condescend to do a deed of arms upon so humble a squire."
"For God," said Manny, "if this be the devil, then the devil hath a very courtly tongue. I will have him out of his armor if he blast me." So saying, he sprang once more from his horse, and plunging his hand down the slit in the collapsed gorget, he closed it tightly upon a fistful of Nigel's yellow curls. The groan that came forth was enough to convince him that it was indeed a man who lurked within. At the same time, his eyes fell upon the hole in the mail corselet which had served the squire as a visor, and he burst into deep-chested mirth. The king, the prince, and Chandos, who had watched the scene from a distance, too much amused by it to explain or interfere, rode up, weary with laughter, now that all was discovered.
"Let him out," said the king, with his hand to his side. "I pray you to unlace him and let him out. I have shed in many a spear-running, but never have I been nearer falling from my horse than as I watched this one. I fear the fall had struck him senseless, since he lay so still."
Nigel had, indeed, lain with all the breath shaken from his body, and as he was unaware that his helmet had been carried off, he had not understood either the alarm or the amusement that he had caused. Now freed from the great hauberk in which he had been shut like a pea in a pod, he stood blinking in the light, blushing deeply with shame that the shifts to which his poverty had reduced him should be exposed to all these laughing courtiers. It was the king who brought him comfort.
"You have shown that you can use your father's weapons," said he, "and you have proved also that you are the worthy bearer of his name and his arms, for you have within you that spirit for which he was famous. But I wot that neither he nor you would suffer a train of hungry men to starve before your door. So lead on, I pray you, and if the meat be as good as this grace before it, then it will be feast indeed."
End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of Sir Nigel. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 10. How the King greeted his Seneschal of Calais. It would have fared ill with the good name of Tilford Manor House, and with the housekeeping of the aged Dame Ermyntrude, had the king's whole retinue, with his outer and inner marshal, his justiciar, his chamberlain and his guard, all gathered under the one roof. But by the foresight and the gentle management of Chandos, this calamity was avoided, so that some were quartered at the great abbey, and others passed on to enjoy the hospitality of Sir Roger FitzAlan at Farnham Castle. Only the king himself, the prince, Manny, Chandos, Sir Hubert de Burgh, the bishop and two or three more remained as the guests of the Lorings. But small as was the party and humble the surroundings, the king in no way relaxed that love of ceremony, of elaborate form and of brilliant colouring which was one of his characteristics. The sumpter mules were unpacked, squires ran hither and thither, baths smoked in the bedchambers, silks and satins were unfolded, gold chains gleamed and clinked,
so that when at last, to the long blast of the two court trumpeters, the company took their seats at the board, it was the brightest, fairest scene which those old black rafters had ever spanned. The great influx of foreign knights who had come in their splendor from all parts of Christendom to take part in the opening of the Round Tower of Windsor 6 years before, and to try their luck and their skill at the tournament connected with it, had deeply modified the English fashions of dress. The old tunic, over-tunic, and cyclas were too sad and simple for the new fashions. So now strange and brilliant coat-hardies, pourpoints, court-pies, paltocks and hanselines, and many other wondrous garments, party-coloured or diapered, with looped, embroidered or escalloped edges, flamed and glittered round the king. He himself, in black velvet and gold, formed a dark, rich centre to the finery round him. On his right sat the prince, on his left the bishop, while Dame Ermyntrude marshalled the forces of the household outside, alert and watchful, pouring in her dishes and her flagons at the right moment, rallying her tired servants, encouraging the van, hurrying the rear, hastening up her reserves, the tapping of her oak stick heard everywhere the pressure was the greatest. Behind the king, clad in his best, but looking drab and sorry amid the brilliant costumes round him, Nigel himself, regardless of an aching body and a twisted knee, waited upon his royal guests, who threw many a merry jest at him over their shoulders as they still chuckled at the adventure of the bridge. "By the rood," said King Edward, leaning back with a chicken bone held daintily between the courtesy fingers of his left hand, "the play is too good for this country stage. You must to Windsor with me, Nigel, and bring with you this great suit of harness in which you lurk. There you shall hold the lists with your eyes in your midriff, and unless someone cleave you to the waist, I see not how any harm can befall you. Never have I seen so small a nut in so great a shell." The prince, looking back with laughing eyes, saw by Nigel's flushed and embarrassed face that his poverty hung heavily upon him. "Nay," said he kindly, "such a workman is surely worthy of better tools." "And it is for his master to see that he has them," added the king. "The court armorer will look to it that the next time your helmet is carried away, Nigel, your head shall be inside it." Nigel, red to the roots of his flaxen hair, stammered out some word of thanks. John Chandos, however, had a fresh suggestion, and he cocked a roguish eye as he made it. "Surely, my liege, your bounty is little needed in this case. It is the ancient law of arms that if two cavaliers start to joust, and one, either by maladdress or misadventure, fail to meet the shock, then his arms become the property of him who still holds the lists. This being so, methinks, Sir Hubert de Burgh, that fine hauberk of Milan and the helmet of Bordeaux steel in which you rode to Tilford should remain with our young host as some small remembrance of your visit." And the suggestion raised a general chorus of approval and laughter, in which all joined, save only Sir Hubert himself, who, flushed with anger, fixed his baleful eyes upon Chandos's mischievous and smiling face. "I said that I did not play that foolish game, and I know nothing of its laws," said he. "But you know well, John, that if you would have a bout with sharpened spear or sword, where two ride to the ground and only one away from it, you have not far to go to find it."
"Nay, nay, would you ride to the ground? Surely you had best walk, Hubert," said Chandos. "On your feet, I know well that I should not see your back as we have seen it today. Say what you will, your horse has played you false, and I claim your suit of harness for Nigel Loring."
"Your tongue is overlong, John, and I am weary of its endless clack," said Sir Hubert, his yellow moustache bristling from a scarlet face. "If you claim my harness, do you yourself come and take it. If there is a moon in the sky, you may try this very night, when the board is cleared."
"Nay, fair sirs," cried the king, smiling from one to the other, "this matter must be followed no further. Do you fill a bumper of Gascony, John, and you also, Hubert? Now pledge each other, I pray you, as good and loyal comrades who would scorn to fight save in your king's quarrel. We can spare neither of you when there is so much work for brave hearts over the sea. As to this matter of the harness, John Chandos speaks truly where it concerns a joust in the lists, but we hold that such a law is scarce binding in this, which is but a wayside passage and a gentle trial of arms. On the other hand, in the case of your squire, Master Manny, there can be no doubt that his suit is forfeit."
"It is a grievous hearing for him, my liege," said Walter Manny, "for he is a poor man, and hath been at sore pains to fit himself for the wars. Yet what you say shall be done, fair sire. So if you will come to me in the morning, Squire Loring, John Widdicombe's suit will be handed over to you." "Then with the King's leave I will hand it back to him," said Nigel, troubled and stammering. "For indeed I had rather never ride to the wars than take from a brave man his only suit of plate."
"There spoke your father's spirit," cried the King. "By the rood, Nigel, I like you full well. Let the matter bide in my hands. But I marvel much that Sir Aymery the Lombard hath not come to us yet from Windsor."
From the moment of his arrival at Tilford, again and again King Edward had asked most eagerly whether Sir Aymery had come, and whether there was any news of him, so that the courtiers glanced at each other in wonder. For Aymery was well known to all of them as a famous mercenary of Italy, lately appointed governor of Calais, and this sudden and urgent summons from the King might well mean some renewal of the war with France, which was the dearest wish of every soldier. Twice the King had stopped his meal and sat with sidelong head, his wine cup in his hand, listening attentively when some sound like the clatter of hoofs was heard from outside. But the third time there could be no mistake. The tramp and jingle of the horses broke loud upon the ear, and ended in hoarse voices calling out of the darkness, which were answered by the archers posted as sentries without the door. "Some traveller has indeed arrived, my liege," said Nigel. "What is your royal will?"
"It can be but Aymery," the King answered, "for it was only to him that I left the message that he should follow me hither. Bid him come in, I pray you, and make him very welcome at your board."
Nigel cast open the door, plucking a torch from its bracket as he did so. Half a dozen men-at-arms sat on their horses outside, but one had dismounted, a short, squat, swarthy man with a rat face and quick, restless brown eyes, which peered eagerly past Nigel into the red glare of the well-lit hall.
"I am Sir Aymery of Pavia," he whispered. "For God's sake, tell me, is the King within?"
"He is at table, fair sir, and he bids you to enter."
"One moment, young man, one moment, and a secret word in your ear. Wot you why it is that the King has sent for me?"
Nigel read terror in the dark, cunning eyes which glanced in sidelong fashion into his.
"Nay, I know not." "I would I knew. I would I was sure ere I sought his presence.
You have but to cross the threshold, fair sir, and doubtless you will learn from the King's own lips."
Sir Aymery seemed to gather himself as one who braces for a spring into ice-cold water.
Then he crossed with a quick stride from the darkness into the light. The King stood up and held out his hand with a smile upon his long, handsome face, and yet it seemed to the Italian that it was the lips which smiled, but not the eyes.
"Welcome," cried Edward. "Welcome to our worthy and faithful Seneschal of Calais. Come, sit here before me at the board, for I have sent for you that I may hear your news from over the sea, and thank you for the care that you have taken over that which is as dear to me as wife or child. Set a place for Sir Aymery there, and give him food and drink, for he has ridden fast and far in our service today."
Throughout the long feast which the skill of the Lady Ermyntrude had arranged, Edward chatted lightly with the Italian as well as with the barons near him. Finally, when the last dish was removed and the gravy-soaked rounds of coarse bread which served as plates had been cast to the dogs, the wine flagons were passed round, and old Weathercote, the minstrel, entered timidly with his harp in the hope that he might be allowed to play before the King's Majesty. But Edward had other sport afoot.
"I pray you, Nigel, to send out the servants, so that we may be alone. I would have two men-at-arms at every door, lest we be disturbed in our debate, for it is a matter of privacy. And now, Sir Aymery, these noble lords, as well as I, your master, would fain hear from your own lips how all goes forward in France."
The Italian's face was calm, but he looked restlessly from one to another along the line of his listeners.
"So far as I know, my liege, all is quiet on the French marches," said he.
"You have not heard, then, that they have mustered or gathered to a head with the intention of breaking the truce and making some attempt upon our dominions?"
"Nay, sire, I have heard nothing of it."
"You set my mind much at ease, Aymery," said the King. "For if nothing has come to your ears, then surely it cannot be. It was said that the wild knight de Charny had come down to St. Omer with his eyes upon my precious jewel and his mailed hands ready to grasp it."
"Nay, sire, let him come. He will find the jewel safe in its strong-box with a goodly guard over it."
"You are the guard over my jewel, Aymery?"
"Yes, sire, I am the guard."
"And you are a faithful guard and one whom I can trust, are you not?" "You would not barter away that which is so dear to me
when I have chosen you out of all my army to hold it for me?"
"Nay, sire, what reasons can there be for such questions? They touch my honor very nearly. You know that I would part with Calais only when I parted with my soul."
"Then you know nothing of de Chargny's attempt?"
"Nothing, sire."
"Liar and villain!" yelled the king, springing to his feet and dashing his fist upon the table until the glasses rattled again. "Seize him, archers! Seize him this instant! Stand close by either elbow, lest he do himself a mischief. Now, do you dare to tell me to my face, you perjured Lombard, that you know nothing of de Chargny and his plans?"
"As God is my witness, I know nothing of him." The man's lips were white, and he spoke in a thin, sighing, reedy voice, his eyes wincing away from the fell gaze of the angry king.
Edward laughed bitterly and drew a paper from his breast. "You are the judges in this case, you, my fair son, and you, Chandos, and you, Manny, and you, Sir Hubert, and you also, my Lord Bishop. By my sovereign power, I make you a court that you may deal justice upon this man, for by God's eyes I will not stir from this room until I have sifted the matter to the bottom. And first, I would read you this letter. It is superscribed to Sir Aymery of Pavia, nom le Lombard, Chateau de Calais. Is that not your name and style, you rogue?"
"It is my name, sire, but no such letter has come to me."
"Else had your villainy never been disclosed. It is signed Isidore de Chargny. What says my enemy de Chargny to my trusted servant? Listen. 'We would not come with the last moon, for we have not gathered sufficient strength, nor have we been able to collect the 20,000 crowns which are your price. But with the next turn of the moon in the darkest hour, we shall come, and you will be paid your money at the small postern gate with a rowan bush beside it.' Well, rogue, what do you say now?"
"It is a forgery," gasped the Italian.
I pray that you will let me see it, sire," said Chandos. "De Chargny was my prisoner, and so many letters passed ere his ransom was paid that his script is well known to me." "Yes, yes, I will swear that this is indeed his. If my salvation were at stake, I could swear it."
"If it were indeed written by de Chargny, it was to dishonor me," cried Sir Aymery.
"Nay, nay," said the young prince. "We all know de Chargny, and have fought against him. Many faults he has, a boaster and a brawler, but a braver man, and one of greater heart and higher of enterprise, does not ride beneath the lilies of France. Such a man would never stoop to write a letter for the sake of putting dishonor upon one of knightly rank. I, for one, will never believe it." A gruff murmur from the others showed that they were of one mind with the prince. The light of the torches from the walls beat upon the line of stern faces at the high table. They had sat like flint, and the Italian shrank from their inexorable eyes. He looked swiftly round, but armed men choked every entrance. The shadow of death had fallen athwart his soul. "This letter," said the king, "was given by de Chargny to one Dom Beauvais, a priest of St. Omer, to carry into Calais. The said priest, smelling a reward, brought it to one who is my faithful servant, and so it came to me. Straightway I sent for this man, that he should come to me. Meanwhile the priest has returned, so that de Chargny may think that his message is indeed delivered."
"I know nothing of it," said the Italian doggedly, licking his dry lips.
A dark flush mounted to the king's forehead, and his eyes were gorged with his wrath. "No more of this, for God's dignity!" he cried. "Had we this fellow at the tower, a few turns of the rack would tear a confession from his craven soul. But why should we need his word for his own guilt? You have seen, my lords, you have heard. How say you, fair son? Is the man guilty?"
"Sire, he is guilty."
"And you, John? And you, Walter? And you, Hubert? And you, my Lord Bishop? You are all of one mind, then?"
"He is guilty of the betrayal of his trust."
"And the punishment?"
"It can be only death," said the prince, and each in turn the others nodded their agreement.
"Aymery of Pavia, you have heard your doom," said Edward, leaning his chin upon his hand and glooming at the cowering Italian. "Step forward, you, archer at the door. You with the black beard. Draw your sword. Nay, you white-faced rogue, I would not dishonor this roof-tree by your blood. It is your heels, not your head, that we want. Hack off those golden spurs of knighthood with your sword, archer. 'Twas I who gave them, and I who take them back. Ha! They fly across the room, and with them every bond betwixt you and the worshipful order whose sign and badge they are. Now, lead him out on the heath afar from the house, where his carrion can best lie, and hew his scheming head from his body as a warning to all such traitors.
The Italian, who had slipped from his chair to his knees, uttered a cry of despair as an archer seized him by either shoulder. Writhing out of their grip, he threw himself upon the floor and clutched at the king's feet. "Spare me, most dread lord, spare me, I beseech you. In the name of Christ's passion, I implore your grace and pardon. Bethink you, my good and dear lord, how many years have I served under your banners, and how many services I have rendered? Was it not I who found the ford upon the Seine 2 days before the great battle? Was it not I also who marshalled the attack at the intaking of Calais? I have a wife and 4 children in Italy, great king, and it was the thought of them which led me to fall from my duty, for this money would have allowed me to leave the wars and to see them once more. Mercy, my liege, mercy, I implore. The English are a rough race, but not a cruel one." The king sat with a face of doom, but the others looked askance and fidgeted in their seats.
"Indeed, my fair liege," said Chandos, "I pray you that you will abate somewhat of your anger."
Edward shook his head curtly.
"Be silent, John. It shall be as I have said."
"I pray you, my dear and honored liege, not to act with overmuch haste in the matter," said Manny. "Bind him and hold him until the morning, for other counsels may prevail."
"Nay, I have spoken. Lead him out."
But the trembling man clutched to the king's knees in such a fashion that the archers could not disengage his convulsive grip.
"Listen to me a moment, I implore you. Give me but 1 minute to plead with you, and then do what you will."
The king leaned back in his chair. "Speak and have done," said he.
"You must spare me, my noble liege. For your own sake I say that you must spare me, for I can set you in the way of such a knightly adventure as will gladden your heart. Bethink you, sire, that this de Chargny and his comrades know nothing of their plans having gone awry. If I do but send them a message, they will surely come to the postern gate. Then, if we have placed our bushment with skill, we shall have such a capture and such a ransom as will fill your coffers. He and his comrades should be worth a good 100,000 crowns.
Edward spurned the Italian away from him with his foot until he sprawled among the rushes, but even as he lay there like a wounded snake, his dark eyes never left the king's face.
"You double traitor!
You would sell Calais to de Chargny, and then in turn you would sell de Chargny to me. How dare you suppose that I, or any noble knight, had such a huckster's soul as to think only of ransoms where honor is to be won? Could I, or any true man, be so caitiff and so thrall? You have sealed your own doom. Lead him out."
"One instant, I pray you, my fair and most sweet lord," cried the prince. "Assuage your wrath yet a little while, for this man's rede deserves perhaps more thought than we have given it. He has turned your noble soul sick with his talk of ransoms, but look at it, I pray you, from the side of honor. And where could we find such hope of worshipfully winning worship? I pray you to let me put my body in this adventure, for it is one from which, if rightly handled, much advancement is to be gained."
Edward looked with sparkling eyes at the noble youth at his side. "Never was hound more keen on the track of stricken heart than you on the hope of honor, fair son," said he.
"How do you conceive the matter in your mind?"
"De Chargny and his men will be such as are worth going far to meet, for he will have the pick of France under his banner that night. If we did as this man says, and awaited him with the same number of lances, then I cannot think that there is any spot in Christendom where one would rather be than in Calais that night."
"By the rood, fair son, you are right," cried the king, his face shining with the thought. "Now, which of you, John Chandos or Walter Manny, will take the thing in charge?"
He looked mischievously from one to the other, like a master who dangles a bone betwixt 2 fierce old hounds. All they had to say was in their burning, longing eyes.
"Nay, John, you must not take it amiss, but it is Walter's turn, and he shall have it. Shall we not all go under your banner, sire, or that of the prince?"
"Nay, it is not fitting that the royal banners of England should be advanced in so small an adventure. And yet, if you have space in your ranks for 2 more cavaliers, both the prince and I would ride with you that night." The young man stooped and kissed his father's hand. "Take this man in your charge, Walter, and do with him as you will. Guard well lest he betray us once again. Take him from my sight, for his breath poisons the room. And now, Nigel, if that worthy greybeard of thine would fain twang his harp or sing to us, but what in God's name would you have?"
He had turned to find his young host upon his knee, and his flaxen head bent in entreaty.
"What is it, man? What do you crave?"
"A boon, fair liege."
"Well, well,
am I to have no peace tonight with a traitor kneeling to me in front and a true man on his knees behind? Out with it, Nigel. What would you have?"
"To come with you to Calais."
"By the rood, your request is fair enough, seeing that our plot is hatched beneath your very roof. How say you, Walter? Will you take him, armor and all?" asked King Edward.
"Say rather, will you take me?" said Chandos. "We two are rivals in honor, Walter, but I am very sure that you would not hold me back."
"Nay, John, I would be proud to have the best lance in Christendom beneath my banner."
"And I to follow so knightly a leader, but Nigel Loring is my squire, and so he comes with us also."
"Then that is settled," said the king. "And now there is no need for hurry, since there can be no move until the moon has changed. So I pray you to pass the flagon once again, and to drink with me to the good knights of France. May they be of great heart and high of enterprise when we all meet once more within the castle wall of Calais."
End of chapter 10.
Chapter 11 of Sir Nigel. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 11. In the Hall of the Knight of Duplin. The king had come and gone. Tilford Manor House stood once more dark and silent, but joy and contentment reigned within its walls. In one night every trouble had fallen away like some dark curtain which had shut out the sun. A princely sum of money had come from the king's treasurer, given in such fashion that there could be no refusal. With a bag of gold pieces at his saddle-bow, Nigel rode once more into Guildford, and not a beggar on the way who had not cause to bless his name. There he had gone first to the goldsmith, and had bought back cup and salver and bracelet, mourning with the merchant over the evil chance that gold and goldwork had, for certain reasons which only those in the trade could fully understand, gone up in value during the last week, so that already 50 gold pieces had to be paid more than the price which Nigel had received. In vain the faithful Aylward fretted and fumed, and muttered a prayer that the day would come when he might feather a shaft in the merchant's portly paunch. The money had to be paid. Thence Nigel hurried to Wat the armourer's, and there he bought that very suit for which he had yearned so short a time before. Then and there he tried it on in Booth, Wat and his boy walking round him with spanner and wrench, fixing bolts and twisting rivets. "How is that, my fair sir?" cried the armourer, as he drew the bassinet over the head and fastened it to the camail which extended to the shoulders. "I swear by Tubal Cain that it fits you as the shell fits the crab. A finer suit never came from Italy or Spain." Nigel stood in front of a burnished shield which served as a mirror, and he turned this way and that, preening himself like a little shining bird. His smooth breastplate, his wondrous joints with their deft protection by the discs at knee and elbow and shoulder, the beautifully flexible gauntlets and solarets, the shirt of mail and the close-fitting greave-plates were all things of joy and of beauty in his eyes. He sprang about the shop to show his lightness, and then, running out, he placed his hand on the pommel and vaulted onto Pommer's saddle, while Wat and his boy applauded in the doorway. Then, springing off and running into the shop again, he clanked down upon his knees before the image of the Virgin upon the smithy wall. There, from his heart, he prayed that no shadow or stain should come upon his soul or his honour while these arms encased his body, and that he might be strengthened to use them for noble and godly ends. A strange turn this to a religion of peace, and yet for many a century the sword and the faith had upheld each other, and in a darkened world the best ideal of the soldier had turned in some dim groping fashion toward the light. Benedictus Dominus Deus Meus, qui docet manus meus ad praelim et digitos meus ad bellum. There spoke the soul of the knightly soldier. So the armour was trussed upon the armourer's mule, and went back with them to Tilford, where Nigel put it on once more for the pleasure of the Lady Ermyntrude, who clapped her skinny hands and shed tears of mingled pain and joy, pain that she would lose him, joy that he should go so bravely to the wars. As to her own future, it had been made easy for her, since it was arranged that a steward should look to the Tilford estate, whilst she had at her disposal a suite of rooms in Royal Windsor, where, with other venerable dames of her own age and standing, she could spend the twilight of her days discussing long-forgotten scandals and whispering sad things about the grandfathers and the grandmothers of the young courtiers all around them. There Nigel might leave her with an easy mind when he turned his face to France. But there was one more visit to be paid, and one more farewell to be spoken, ere Nigel could leave the moorlands where he had dwelled so long. That evening he donned his brightest tunic, dark purple velvet of Genoa with trimming of miniver, his hat with a snow-white feather curling round the front, and his belt of embossed silver round his loins. Mounted on lordly pommers, with his hawk upon his wrist and his sword by his side, never did fairer young gallant, or one more modest in mind, set forth upon such an errand. It was but the old knight of Duplin to whom he would say farewell, but the knight of Duplin had two daughters, Edith and Mary, and Edith was the fairest maid in all the heather country. Sir John Butsthorn, the knight of Duplin, was so called because he had been present at that strange battle, some 18 years before, when the full power of Scotland had been, for a moment, beaten to the ground by a handful of adventurers and mercenaries, marching under the banner of no nation, but fighting in their own private quarrel. Their exploits filled no pages of history, for it is to the interest of no nation to record it, and yet the rumour and the fame of the great fight bulked large in those times. For it was on that day when the flower of Scotland was left dead upon the field, that the world first understood that a new force had arisen in war, and that the English archer, with his robust courage, and his skill with the weapon which he had wielded from his boyhood, was a power which even the mailed chivalry of Europe had seriously to reckon. Sir John, after his return from Scotland, had become the king's own head huntsman, famous throughout all England for his knowledge of venery, until at last, getting over-heavy for his horses, he had settled in modest comfort into the old house of Cosford upon the eastern slope of the Hindhead Hill. Here, as his face grew redder and his beard more white, he spent the evening of his days amid hawks and hounds, a flagon of spiced wine ever at his elbow, and his swollen foot perched upon a stool before him. There it was that many an old comrade broke his journey as he passed down the rude road which led from London to Portsmouth, and thither also came the young gallants of the country to hear the stout knight's tales of old wars, or to learn from him that lore of the forest and the chase which none could teach so well as he. But sooth to say, whatever the old knight might think, it was not merely his old tales and older wine which drew the young men to Cosford, but rather the fair face of his younger daughter, or the strong soul and wise counsel of the elder. Never had two more different branches sprung from the same trunk. Both were tall and of a queenly graceful figure, but there all resemblance began and ended. Edith was yellow as the ripe corn, blue-eyed, winning, mischievous, with a chattering tongue, a merry laugh, and a smile which a dozen of young gallants, Nigel of Tilford at their head, could share equally amongst them. Like a young kitten, she played with all the things that she found in life, and some there were who thought that already the claws could be felt amid the patting of her velvet touch. Mary was dark as night, grave-featured, plain-visaged, with steady brown eyes looking bravely at the world from under a strong black arch of brows. None could call her beautiful, and when her fair sister cast her arm round her and placed her cheek against hers, as was her habit when company was there, the fairness of the one and the plainness of the other leapt visibly to the eyes of all, each the clearer for that hard contrast. And yet, here and there was one who, looking at her strange, strong face, and at the passing gleams far down in her dark eyes, felt that this silent woman, with her proud bearing and her queenly grace, had in her something of strength, of reserve, and of mastery, which was more to them than all the dainty glitter of her sister. Such were the ladies of Cosford towards whom Nigel Loring rode that night, with doublet of Genoan velvet and the new white feather in his cap. He had ridden over Thursley Ridge, past that old stone where in days gone by at the place of Thor the wild Saxons worshipped their war god. Nigel looked at it with a wary eye, and spurred Pommers onward as he passed it, for still it was said that wild fires danced round it on moonless nights, and they who had ears for such things could hear the scream and sob of those whose lives had been ripped from them, that the fiend might be honoured. Thor's stone, Thor's jumps, Thor's punch-bowl, the whole countryside was one grim monument to the god of battles, though the pious monks had changed his uncouth name for that of the devil, his father, so that it was the devil's jumps and the devil's punch-bowl of which they spoke. Nigel glanced back at the old grey boulder, and he felt for an instant a shudder pass through his stout heart. Was it the chill of the evening air, or was it that some inner voice had whispered to him of the day when he also might lie bound on such a rock and have such a blood-stained pagan crew howling around him? An instant later the rock and his vague fear and all things else had passed from his mind, for there, down the yellow sandy path, the setting sun gleaming on her golden hair, her lithe figure bending and swaying with every heave of the cantering horse, was none other than the same fair Edith, whose face had come so often betwixt him and his sleep. His blood rushed hot to his face at the sight, for fearless of all else, his spirit was attracted and yet daunted by the delicate mystery of woman. To his pure and knightly soul, not Edith alone, but every woman sat high and aloof, enthroned and exalted, with a thousand mystic excellencies and virtues which raised her far above the rude world of man. There was joy in contact with them, and yet there was fear. Fear lest his own unworthiness, his untrained tongue or rougher ways, should in some way break rudely upon this delicate and tender thing. Such was his thought as the white horse cantered toward him. But a moment later his vague doubts were set at rest by the frank voice of the young girl, who waved her whip in merry greeting. "Hail and well met, Nigel!" she cried. "Whither away this evening? Sure I am that it is not to see your friends of Cosford, for when did you ever don so brave a doublet for us? Come, Nigel, her name, that I may hate her forever!"
"Nay, Edith," said the young squire, laughing back at the laughing girl, "I was indeed coming to Cosford."
"Then we shall ride back together, for I will go no further. How think you that I am looking?"
Nigel's answer was in his eyes as he glanced at the fair flushed face, the golden hair, the sparkling eyes, and the daintily graceful figure set off in a scarlet and black riding dress.
"You are as fair as ever, Edith."
"Oh, cold of speech! Surely you were bred for the cloisters and not for a lady's bower, Nigel. Had I asked such a question from young Sir George Brocas, or the Squire of Fernhurst, he would have raved from here to Cosford. They are both more to my taste than you are, Nigel."
"It is the worse for me, Edith," said Nigel ruefully.
"Nay, but you must not lose heart."
"Have I not already lost it?" said he.
"That is better," she cried, laughing. "You can be quick enough when you choose, Master Malapert, but you're more fit to speak of high and weary matters with my sister Mary. She will have none of the prattle and courtesy of Sir George, and yet I love them well. But tell me, Nigel, why do you come to Cosford to-night?"
"To bid you farewell."
"Me alone?"
"Nay, Edith, you and your sister, and the good knight, your father."
"Sir George would have said that he had come for me alone. Indeed, you are but a poor courtier beside him. But is it true, Nigel, that you go to France?"
"Yes, Edith."
"It was so rumored after the king had been to Tilford. The story goes that the king goes to France, and you in his train. Is that true?"
"Yes, Edith, it is true."
"Tell me, then, to which part do you go, and when?"
"That, alas, I may not say."
"Oh, in sooth!"
She tossed her fair head, and rode onward in silence, with compressed lips and angry eyes. Nigel glanced at her in surprise and dismay.
"Surely, Edith," said he at last, "you have overmuch regard for my honor that you should wish me to break the word that I have given." "Your honor belongs to you, and my likings belong to me," said she. "You hold fast to the one, and I will do the same by the other."
They rode in silence through Thursley village. Then a thought came to her mind, and in an instant her anger was forgotten, and she was hot on a new scent.
"What would you do if I were injured, Nigel? I have heard my father say that, small as you are,
there is no man in these parts could stand against you. Would you be my champion if I suffered wrong? Surely I or any man of gentle blood would be the champion of any woman who had suffered wrong. You or any, and I or any, what sort of speech is that? Is it a compliment, think you, to be mixed with a drove in that fashion? My question was of you and me. If I were wronged, would you be my man? Try me and see, Edith. Then I will do so, Nigel. Either Sir George Brocas or the Squire of Fernhurst would gladly do what I ask, and yet I'm of a mind, Nigel, to turn to you. I pray you to tell me what it is. You know Paul de la Fosse of Shalford? You mean the small man with the twisted back? He's no smaller than yourself, Nigel, and as to his back, there are many folk that I know would be glad to have his face. Nay, I am no judge of that, and I spoke out of no discourtesy. What of the man? He has flouted me, Nigel, and I would have revenge. What? On that poor twisted creature? I tell you that he has flouted me. But how? I should have thought that a true cavalier would have flown to my aid without all these questions. But I will tell you, since I needs must. Know then that he was one of those who came around me and professed to be my own. Then, merely because he thought that there were others who were as dear to me as himself, he left me. And now he pays court to Maud Twynham, the little freckle-faced hussy in his village. But how has this hurt you, since he was no man of thine? He was one of my men, was he not? And he has made game of me to his wench. He has told her things about me. He has made me foolish in her eyes. Yes, yes, I can read it in her saffron face and in her watery eyes when we meet at the church door on Sundays. She smiles. Yes, smiles at me. Nigel, go to him. Do not slay him or even wound him, but lay his face open with thy riding whip, and then come back to me and tell me how I can serve you. Nigel's face was haggard with the strife within, for desire ran hot in every vein, and yet reason shrank with horror. "By St. Paul, Edith," he cried, "I see no honor nor advancement of any sort in this thing which you have asked me to do. Is it for me to strike one who is no better than a cripple? For my manhood I could not do such a deed, and I pray you, dear lady, that you will set me some other task." Her eyes flashed at him in contempt. "And you are a man at arms," she cried, laughing in bitter scorn. "You are afraid of a little man who can scarce walk. Yes, yes, say what you will, I shall ever believe that you have heard of his skill at fence and of his great spirit, and that your heart has failed you. You are right, Nigel. He is indeed a perilous man. Had you done what I asked, he would have slain you, and so you have shown your wisdom." Nigel flushed and winced under the words, but he said no more, for his mind was fighting hard within him, striving to keep that high image of woman which seemed for a moment to totter on the edge of a fall. Together, in silence, side by side, the little man and the stately woman, the yellow charger and the white jennet, passed up the sandy winding track with the gorse and the bracken head high on either side. Soon a path branched off through a gateway marked with the boar's head of the butthorns, and there was the low widespread house, heavily timbered, loud with the barking of dogs. The ruddy knight limped forth with outstretched hand and roaring voice.
"What how, Nigel? Good welcome and all hail! I had thought that you had given over poor friends like us, now that the king had made so much of you. The horses, varlets, or my crutch will be across you. Hush, Lydiard! Down, Pelamon! I can scarce hear my voice for your yelping. Mary, a cup of wine for young Squire Loring."
She stood framed in the doorway, tall, mystic, silent, with strange, wistful face and deep soul shining in her dark, questioning eyes. Nigel kissed the hand that she held out, and all his faith in woman and his reverence came back to him as he looked at her. Her sister had slipped behind her, and her fair elfish face smiled her forgiveness of Nigel over Mary's shoulder. The knight of Duplin leaned his weight upon the young man's arm and limped his way across the great high-roofed hall to his capacious oaken chair.
"Come, come, the stool, Edith!" he cried. "As God is my help, that girl's mind swarms with gallants as a granary with rats. Well, Nigel, I hear strange tales of your spear running at Tilford, and of the visit of the king. How seemed he? And my old friend Chandos? Many happy hours in the woodlands have we had together, and many, too. He was ever a bold and a hard rider. What news of them all?"
Nigel told to the old knight all that had occurred, saying little of his own success and much of his own failure. Yet the eyes of the dark woman burned the brighter as she sat at her tapestry and listened. Sir John followed the story with a running fire of oaths, prayers, thumps with his great fists, and flourishes of his crutch.
"Well, well, lad, you could scarce expect to hold your saddle against Manny, and you have carried yourself well. We are proud of you, Nigel, for you are our own man, reared in the heather country. But indeed, I take shame that you are not more skilled in the mystery of the woods, seeing that I have had the teaching of you, and that no one in broad England is my master at the craft. I pray you to fill your cup again whilst I make use of the little time that is left to us."
And straightway the old knight began a long and weary lecture upon the times of grace, and when each beast and bird was seasonable, with many anecdotes, illustrations, warnings and exceptions drawn from his own great experience. He spoke also of the several ranks and grades of the chase, how the hare, hart, and boar must ever take precedence over the buck, the doe, and the fox, the marten, and the roe, even as a knight banneret does over a knight, while these in turn are of a higher class than the badger, the wildcat, or the otter, who are but the common populace of the world of beasts. Of bloodstains also he spoke, how the skilled hunter may see at a glance if blood be dark and frothy, which means a mortal hurt, or thin and clear, which means that the arrow has struck a bone.
"By such signs," said he, "you will surely know whether to lay on the hounds and cast down the blinks which hinder the stricken deer in its flight. But above all, I pray you, Nigel, to have a care in the use of the terms of the craft, lest you should make some blunder at table, so that those who are wiser may have the laugh of you, and we who love you may be shamed."
"Nay, Sir John," said Nigel, "I think that after your teaching I can hold my place with the others." The old knight shook his white head doubtfully.
"There is so much to be learned that there is no one who can be said to know all," said he. "For example, Nigel, it is sooth that for every collection of beasts of the forest, and for every gathering of birds of the air, there is their own private name, so that none may be confused with another."
"I know it, fair sir."
"You know it, Nigel, but you do not know each separate name, else you are a wiser man than I had thought you. In truth, none can say that they know all, though I have myself pricked off 80 and 6 for a wager at court, and it is said that the chief huntsman of the Duke of Burgundy has counted over 100. But it is in my mind that he may have found them as he went, for there was none to say him nay. Now answer me now, lad, how would you say if you saw 10 badgers together in a forest?"
"A seat of badgers, fair sir."
"Good, Nigel, good, by my faith. And if you walk in Woolmer Forest and see a swarm of foxes, how would you call it?"
A skulk of foxes.
"And if they be lions?"
"Nay, fair sir, I am not like to meet several lions in Woolmer Forest."
"Aye, lad, but there are other forests besides Woolmer, and other lands besides England. And who can tell how far afield such a knight-errant as Nigel of Tilford may go when he sees worship to be won? We will say that you were in the deserts of Nubia, and that afterward, at the court of the great Sultan, you wished to say that you had seen several lions, which is the first beast of the chase, being the king of all animals. How then would you say it?"
Nigel scratched his head. "Surely, fair sir, I would be content to say that I had seen a number of lions, if indeed I could say aught after so wondrous an adventure."
"Nay, Nigel, a huntsman would have said that he had seen a pride of lions, and so proved that he knew the language of the chase. Now, had it been boars instead of lions?"
"One says a singular of boars."
"And if they be swine?"
"Surely it is a herd of swine."
"Nay, nay, lad, it is indeed sad to see how little you know. Your hands, Nigel, were always better than your head. No man of gentle birth would speak of a herd of swine. That is the peasant speech. If you drive them, it is a herd. If you hunt them, it is other. What call you them, then, Edith?"
"Nay, I know not," said the girl listlessly. A crumpled note brought in by a varlet was clinched in her right hand, and her blue eyes looked afar into the deep shadows of the roof.
But you can tell us, Mary.
Surely, sweet sir, one talks of a sounder of swine. The old knight laughed exultantly.
Here is a pupil who never brings me shame, he cried. Be it lore of chivalry, or heraldry, or woodcraft, or what you will, I can always turn to Mary. Many a man can she put to blush.
Myself among them, said Nigel.
Ah, lad, you are a Solomon to some of them. Hark ye, only last week, that jackfool, the young lord of Brocas, was here talking of having seen a covey of pheasants in the wood. One such speech would have been the ruin of a young squire at the court. How would you have said it, Nigel?
Surely, fair sir, it should be a nigh of pheasants.
Good, Nigel, a nigh of pheasants. Even as it is a gaggle of geese, or a battling of ducks, a fall of woodcock, or a wisp of snipe. But a covey of pheasants, what sort of talk is that? I made him sit even where you are sitting, Nigel, and I saw the bottom of two pots of Rhenish ere I let him up. Even then I fear that he had no great profit from his lesson, for he was casting his foolish eyes at Edith when he should have been turning his ears to her father. But where is the wench?
She hath gone forth, father.
She ever doth go forth when there is a chance of learning aught that is useful indoors. But supper will soon be ready, and there is a boar's ham fresh from the forest, with which I would ask your help, Nigel, and a side of venison from the king's own chase. The tynemen and verderers have not forgotten me yet. My larder is ever full. Blow three moots on the horn, Mary, that the varlets may set the table, for the growing shadow and my loosening belt warn me that it is time.
End of chapter 11.
Chapter 12 of Sir Nigel. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 12. How Nigel fought the Twisted Man of Shalford. In the days of which you read, all classes, save perhaps the very poor, fared better in meat and in drink than they have ever done since. The country was covered with woodlands. There were 70 separate forests in England alone, some of them covering half a shire. Within these forests, the great beasts of the chase were strictly preserved. But the smaller game, the hares, the rabbits, the birds which swarmed round the coverts, found their way readily into the poor man's pot. Ale was very cheap, and cheaper still was the mead which every peasant could make for himself out of the wild honey in the tree trunks. There were many tea-like drinks also, which were brewed by the poor at no expense. Mallow tea, tansy tea, and others the secret of which has passed. Amid the richer classes there was rude profusion, great joints ever on the sideboard, huge pies, beasts of the field and beasts of the chase, with ale and rough French or Rhenish wines to wash them down. But the very rich had attained to a high pitch of luxury in their food, and cookery was a science in which the ornamentation of the dish was almost as important as the dressing of the food itself. It was gilded, it was silvered, it was painted, it was surrounded with flame. From the boar and the peacock, down to such strange food as the porpoise and the hedgehog, every dish had its own setting and its own sauce, very strange and very complex, with flavourings of dates, currants, cloves, vinegar, sugar and honey, of cinnamon, ground ginger, sandalwood, saffron, brawn and pines. It was the Norman tradition to eat in moderation, but to have a great profusion of the best and of the most delicate from which to choose. From them came this complex cookery, so unlike the rude and often gluttonous simplicity of the old Teutonic stock. Sir John Butsthorn was of that middle class who fared in the old fashion, and his great oak supper-table groaned beneath the generous pasties, the mighty joints and the great flagons. Below were the household, above, on a raised dais, the family table, with places ever ready for those frequent guests who dropped in from the high road outside. Such a one had just come, an old priest, journeying from the Abbey of Chertsey to the Priory of St. John at Midhurst. He passed often that way, and never without breaking his journey at the hospitable board of Cosford.
"Welcome again, good Father Athanasius," cried the burly knight.
Come, sit here on my right, and give me the news of the countryside, for there is never a scandal but the priests are first to know it."
The priest, a kindly, quiet man, glanced at an empty place upon the further side of his host. "A Mistress Edith?" said he.
"Aye, aye, where is the hussy?" cried her father impatiently. "Mary, I beg you to have the horn blown again, that she may know that the supper is on the table. What can the little owlet do abroad at this hour of the night?"
There was trouble in the priest's gentle eyes as he touched the knight upon his sleeve. "I have seen Mistress Edith within this hour," said he. "I fear that she will hear no horn that you may blow, for she must be at Milford ere now."
"At Milford? What does she there?"
"I pray you, good Sir John, to abate your voice somewhat, for indeed this matter is for our private discourse, since it touches the honour of a lady."
"Her honour?"
Sir John's ruddy face had turned redder still as he stared at the troubled features of the priest.
"Her honour, say you? The honour of my daughter? Make good these words, or never set your foot over the threshold of Cosford again."
"I trust that I have done no wrong, Sir John, but indeed I must say what I have seen, else I would be a false friend and an unworthy priest."
"Haste, man, haste! What in the devil's name have you seen?"
"Know you a little man, partly misshapen, named Paul de la Fosse?"
"I know him well. He is a man of noble family and coat armour, being the younger brother of Sir Eustace de la Fosse of Shalford. Time was when I thought that I might call him son, for there was never a day that he did not pass with my girls, but I fear that his crooked back sped him ill in his wooing."
"Alas, Sir John, it is his mind that is more crooked than his back. He is a perilous man with women, for the devil hath given him such a tongue and such an eye that he charms them even as the basilisk. Marriage may be in their mind, but never in his, so that I could count a dozen and more whom he has led to their undoing. It is his pride and his boast over the whole countryside."
"Well, well, what is that to me or mine?"
"Even now, Sir John, as I rode my mule up the road, I met this man speeding towards his home. A woman rode by his side, and though her face was hooded, I heard her laugh as she passed me. That laugh I have heard before, and it was under this very roof, from the lips of Mistress Edith." The knight's knife dropped from his hand, but the debate had been such that neither Mary nor Nigel could fail to have heard it. Mid the rough laughter and clatter of voices from below, the little group at the high table had a privacy of their own. "Fear not, father," said the girl. "Indeed, the good Father Athanasius hath fallen into error, and Edith will be with us anon. I have heard her speak of this man many times of late, and always with bitter words."
"It is true," cried Nigel eagerly. "It was only this very evening, as we rode over Thursley Moor, that Mistress Edith told me that she counted him not a fly, and that she would be glad if he were beaten for his evil deeds."
But the priest shook his silvery locks. "Nay, there is ever danger when a woman speaks like that. Hot hate is twin brother to hot love. Why should she speak so if there were not some bond between them?"
"And yet," said Nigel, "what can have changed her thoughts in 3 short hours? She was here in the hall with us since I came."
"By St. Paul, I will not believe it." Mary's face darkened.
"I call to mind," said she, "that a note was brought her by Hannikin the stable varlet while you were talking to us, fair sir, of the terms of the chase. She read it and went forth."
Sir John sprang to his feet, but sank into his chair again with a groan.
"Oh, would that I were dead," he cried, "ere I saw dishonour come upon my house. And am so tied with this accursed foot that I can neither examine if it be true, nor yet avenge it. If my son Oliver were here, then all would be well. Send me this stable varlet, that I may question him."
"I pray you, fair and honoured sir," said Nigel, "that you will take me for your son this night, that I may handle this matter in the way which seems best. On jeopardy of my honour, I will do all that a man may."
"Nigel, I thank you. There is no man in Christendom to whom I would sooner turn."
"But I would learn your mind in one matter, fair sir. This man, Paul de la Fosse, owns broad acres, as I understand, and comes of noble blood. There is no reason, if things be as we fear, that he should not marry your daughter."
"Nay, she could not wish for better."
"It is well. And first I would question this Hannikin, but it shall be done in such a fashion that none shall know,
for indeed it is not a matter for the gossip of the servants. But if you will show me the man, Mistress Mary, I will take him out to tend to my own horse, and so I shall learn all that he has to tell." Nigel was absent for some time, and when he returned, the shadow upon his face brought little hope to the anxious hearts at the high table. "I have locked him in the stable loft, lest he talk too much," said he, "for my questions must have shown him whence the wind blew." It was, indeed, from this man that the note came, and he brought with him a spare horse for the lady. The old knight groaned, and his face sank upon his hands. "Nay, father, they watch you," whispered Mary. "For the honor of our house, let us keep a bold face to all." Then, raising her young, clear voice, so that it sounded through the room, "If you ride onward, Nigel, I would fain go with you, that my sister may not come back alone." "We will ride together, Mary," said Nigel, rising, and then, in a lower voice, "But we cannot go alone, and if we take a servant, all is known. I pray you to stay at home and leave the matter to me." "Nay, Nigel, she may sorely need a woman's aid, and what woman should it be save her own sister? I can take my tirewoman with us. Nay, I shall ride with you myself if your impatience can keep within the powers of my mule," said the old priest. "But it is not your road, father." "The only road of a true priest is that which leads to the good of others. Come, my children, and we shall go together." And so it was that the stout Sir John Butsthorn, the aged knight of Duplin, was left alone at his own high table, pretending to eat, pretending to drink, fidgeting in his seat, trying hard to seem unconcerned, with his mind and body in a fever, while below him his varlets and handmaids laughed and jested, clattering their cups and clearing their trenches, all unconscious of the dark shadow which threw its gloom over the lonely man upon the dais above. Meantime, the Lady Mary upon the white jennet, which her sister had ridden in the same evening, Nigel on his war horse, and the priest on the mule, clattered down the rude winding road which led to London. The country on either side was a wilderness of heather moors and of morasses, from which came the strange crying of nightfowl. A half-moon shone in the sky between the rifts of hurrying clouds. The lady rode in silence, absorbed in the thought of the task before them, the danger and the shame. Nigel chatted in a low tone with the priest. From him he learned more of the evil name of this man whom they followed. His house in Shalford was a den of profligacy and vice. No woman could cross the threshold and depart unstained. In some strange fashion, inexplicable yet common, the man, with all his evil soul and his twisted body, had yet some strange fascination for women, some mastery over them which compelled them to his will. Again and again he had brought ruin to a household, again and again his adroit tongue and his cunning wit had in some fashion saved him from the punishment of his deeds. His family was great in the county, and his kinsmen held favour with the king, so that his neighbours feared to push things too far against him. Such was the man, malignant and ravenous, who had stooped like some foul night-hawk and borne away to his evil nest the golden beauty of Cosford. Nigel said little as he listened, but he raised his hunting dagger to his tightened lips, and thrice he kissed the cross of its handle. They had passed over the moors, and through the village of Milford and the little township of Godalming, until a path turned southward over the Peasmarsh, and crossed the meadows of Shalford. There on the dark hillside glowed the red points of light which marked the windows of the house which they sought. A sombre arched avenue of oak trees led up to it, and then they were in the moon-silvered clearing in front. From the shadow of the arched door there sprang two rough serving-men, bearded and gruff, great cudgels in their hands, to ask them who they were and what their errand. The Lady Mary had slipped from her horse, and was advancing to the door, but they rudely barred her way.
"Nay, nay, our master needs no more," cried one with a hoarse laugh. "Stand back, mistress, whoever you be. The house is shut, and our lord sees no guests to-night."
"Fellow," said Nigel, speaking low and clear, "stand back from us. Our errand is with your master." "Bethink you, my children," cried the old priest. "Would it not be best, perchance, that I go in to him, and see whether the voice of the church may not soften this hard heart? I fear bloodshed if you enter." "Nay, father, I pray you to stay here for the nonce," said Nigel, And you, Mary, do you bide with the good priest, for we know not what may be within." Again he turned to the door, and again the two men barred his passage. "Stand back, I say. Back for your lives," said Nigel. "By St. Paul, I should think it shame to soil my sword with such as you, but my soul is set, and no man will bar my path this night." The two men shrank back from the deadly menace of the gentle voice. "Hold," said one of them, peering through the darkness. "Is it not Squire Loring of Tilford?" "That is indeed my name." "Had you spoken it, I for one would not have barred your way. But down your staff, Wat, for this is no stranger but the Squire of Tilford." "As well for him," grumbled the other, lowering his cudgel with an inward prayer of thanksgiving. "Had it been otherwise, I should have had blood upon my soul tonight. But our master said nothing of neighbours when he ordered us to hold the door. I will enter and ask him what his will." But Nigel was already past him, and had pushed past the outer door. Swift as he was, the Lady Mary was at his very heels, and the two passed together into the hall beyond. It was a great room, draped and curtained, with black shadows and one vivid circle of light in the centre, where two oil lamps shone upon a small table. A meal was laid upon the table, but only two were seated at it, and there were no servants in the room. At the near end was Edith, her golden hair loose and streaming down over scarlet and black of her riding dress. At the further end, the light beat strongly upon the harsh face and the high-drawn, misshapen shoulders of the lord of the house. A tangle of black hair surmounted a high, rounded forehead, the forehead of a thinker, with two deep-set, cold grey eyes twinkling sharply from under tufted brows. His nose was curved and sharp, like the beak of some cruel bird, but below, the whole of his clean-shaven, powerful face was marred by the loose slabbing mouth and the round folds of the heavy chin. His knife in one hand and a half-gnawed bone in the other, he looked fiercely up, like some beast disturbed in his den, as the two intruders broke in upon his hall. Nigel stopped midway between the door and the table. His eyes and those of Paul de la Fosse were riveted upon each other. But Mary, with her woman's soul flooded over with love and pity, had rushed forward and cast her arms round her younger sister. Edith had sprung up from her chair, and with averted face tried to push the other away from her.
"Edith, Edith, by the Virgin, I implore you to come back with us, and to leave this wicked man," cried Mary. "Dear sister, you would not break our father's heart, nor bring his grey head in dishonour to the grave. Come back, Edith, come back, and all is well."
But Edith pushed her away, and her fair cheeks were flushed with her anger.
"What right have you over me, Mary, you who are but 2 years older, that you should follow me over the countryside as though I were a renegade villain, and you my mistress? Do you yourself go back, and leave me to do that which seems best in my own eyes?"
But Mary still held her in her arms, and still strove to soften the hard and angry heart.
"Our mother is dead, Edith. I thank God that she died ere she saw you under this roof. But I stand for her, as I have done all my life, since I am indeed your elder. It is with her voice that I beg and pray you that you will not trust this man further, and that you will come back ere it be too late."
Edith writhed from her grasp, and stood flushed and defiant, with gleaming, angry eyes fixed upon her sister.
"You may speak evil of him now," said she, "but there was a time when Paul de la Fosse came to Cosford, and who so gentle and soft-spoken to him then as wise, grave Sister Mary? But he has learned to love another. So now he is the wicked man, and it is shame to be seen under his roof. From what I see of my good, pious sister and her cavalier, it is sin for another to ride at night with a man at your side, but it comes easy enough to you. Look at your own eye, good sister, ere you would take the speck from that of another." Mary stood irresolute and greatly troubled, holding down her pride and her anger, but uncertain how best to deal with this strong, wayward spirit. "It is not a time for bitter words, dear sister," said she, and again she laid her hand upon her sister's sleeve. "All that you say may be true. There was indeed a time when this man was friend to us both, and I know, even as you do, the power which he may have to win a woman's heart. But I know him now, and you do not. I know the evil that he has wrought, the dishonour that he has brought, the perjury that lies upon his soul, the confidence betrayed, the promise unfulfilled. All this I know. Am I to see my own sister caught in the same well-used trap? Has it shut upon you, child?
am I indeed already too late? For God's sake, Edith, tell me that it is not so." Edith plucked her sleeve from her sister and made two swift steps to the head of the table. Paul de la Fosse still sat silent with his eyes upon Nigel. Edith laid her hand upon his shoulder. "This is the man I love, and the only man I have ever loved. This is my husband," said she. At the word Mary gave a cry of joy. "And is it so?" she cried. "Nay, then, all is in honour, and God will see to the rest. If you are man and wife before the altar, then, indeed, why should I or any other stand between you? Tell me that it is indeed so, and I return this moment to make your father a happy man." Edith pouted like a naughty child. "We are man and wife in the eyes of God. Soon also we shall be wedded before all the world. We do but wait until next Monday, when Paul's brother, who is a priest at St. Albans, will come to wed us. Already a messenger has sped for him, and he will come, will he not, dear love?"
"He will come," said the master of Shalford, still with his eyes fixed upon the silent Nigel.
"It is a lie. He will not come," said a voice from the door. It was the old priest, who had followed the others as far as the threshold. "He will not come," he repeated, as he advanced into the room. "Daughter, my daughter, hearken to the words of one who is indeed old enough to be your earthly father. This lie has served before. He has ruined others before you with it. The man has no brother at St. Albans. I know his brothers well, and there is no priest among them. Before Monday, when it is all too late, you will have found the truth as others have done before you. Trust him not, but come with us." Paul de la Fosse looked up at her with a quick smile and patted the hand upon his shoulder. "Do you speak to them, Edith?" said he. Her eyes flashed with scorn as she surveyed them each in turn, the woman, the youth, and the priest.
"I have but one word to say to them," said she. "It is that they go hence and trouble us no more. Am I not a free woman? Have I not said that this is the only man I ever loved? I have loved him long. He did not know it, and in despair he turned to another. Now he knows all, and never again can doubt come between us. Therefore I will stay here at Shalford, and come to Cosford no more, save upon the arm of my husband. Am I so weak that I would believe the tales you tell against him? Is it hard for a jealous woman and a wandering priest to agree upon a lie? No, no, Mary, you can go hence and take your cavalier and your priest with you, for here I stay, true to my love and safe in my trust upon his honour."
"Well spoken, on my faith, my golden bird," said the little master of Shalford. "Let me add my own word to that which has been said. You would not grant me any virtue in your unkindly speech, good Lady Mary, and yet you must needs confess that at least I have a good store of patience, since I have not set my dogs upon your friends who have come between me and my ease. But even to the most virtuous there comes at last a time when poor human frailty may prevail, and so I pray you to remove both yourself, your priest, and your valiant knight-errant, lest perhaps there be more haste and less dignity when at last you do take your leave. Sit down, my fair love, and let us turn once more to our supper."
He motioned her to a chair, and filled her wine-cup as well as his own. Nigel had said no word since he had entered the room, but his look had never lost its set purpose, nor had his brooding eyes ever wandered from the sneering face of the deformed master of Shalford. Now he turned with swift decision to Mary and to the priest. "That is over," said he, in a low voice. "You have done all that you could, and now it is for me to play my part as well as I am able. I pray you, Mary, and you, good father, that you will await me outside."
"Nay, Nigel, if there is danger..."
"It is easier for me, Mary, if you are not there. I pray you to go. I can speak to this man more at my ease." She looked at him with questioning eyes, and then obeyed. Nigel plucked at the priest's gown. "I pray you, father, have you your book of offices with you?"
"Surely, Nigel, it is ever in my breast."
"Have it ready, father."
"For what, my son?"
"There are two places you may mark. There is the service of marriage, and there is the prayer for the dying. Go with her, father, and be ready at my call." He closed the door behind them and was alone with this ill-matched couple. They both turned in their chairs to look at him, Edith with a defiant face, the man with a bitter smile upon his lips and a malignant hatred in his eyes. "What is it?" said he. "The knight-errant still lingers. Have we not heard of his thirst for glory? What new venture does he see that he should tarry here?" Nigel walked to the table. "There is no glory and little venture," said he. "But I have come for a purpose, and I must do it. I learn from your own lips, Edith, that you will not leave this man."
"If you have ears, you have heard it."
"But you are, as you have said, a free woman, and who can gainsay you? But I have known you, Edith, since we played as boy and girl on the heather hills together. I will save you from this man's cunning and from your own foolish weakness."
"What would you do?"
"There is a priest without. He will marry you now. I will see you married ere I leave this hall."
"Or else,"
sneered the man, "or else you never leave this hall alive. Nay, call not for your servants or your dogs. By St. Paul, I swear to you that this matter lies between us three, and that if any fourth comes at your call, you, at least, shall never live to see what comes of it. Speak then, Paul of Shalford, will you wed this woman now, or will you not?" Edith was on her feet, with outstretched arms between them.
"Stand back, Nigel. He is small and weak. You would not do him a hurt. Did you not say this very day? For God's sake, Nigel, do not look at him so. There is death in your eyes."
"A snake may be small and weak, Edith, yet every honest man would place his heel upon it. Do you stand back yourself, for my purpose is set."
"Paul!" She turned her eyes to the pale, sneering face. "Bethink you, Paul, why should you not do as he asks? What matter to you whether it be now or Monday? I pray you, dear Paul, for my sake, let him have his way. Your brother can read the service again, if it so please him. Let us wed now, Paul, and then all is well."
He had risen from his chair, and he dashed aside her appealing hands.
"You foolish woman," he snarled, "and you, my savior of fair damsels, who are so bold against a cripple, you have both to learn that if my body be weak, there is the soul of my breed within it. To marry because a boasting, ranting country squire would have it so? No. By the soul of God, I will die first. On Monday I will marry, and no day sooner. So let that be your answer."
"It is the answer that I wished," said Nigel, "for indeed I see no happiness in this marriage, and the other may well be the better way. Stand aside, Edith." He gently forced her to one side and drew his sword.
De La Fosse cried aloud at the sight. "I have no sword. You would not murder me," said he,
leaning back with haggard face and burning eyes against his chair. The bright steel shone in the lamplight. Edith shrank back, her hand over her face. "Take this sword," said Nigel, and he turned the hilt to the cripple. "Now," he added, as he drew his hunting knife, "kill me if you can, Paul de la Fosse, for as God is my help, I will do as much for you." The woman, half swooning and yet spellbound and fascinated, looked on at that strange combat. For a moment the cripple stood with an air of doubt, the sword grasped in his nerveless fingers. Then, as he saw the tiny blade in Nigel's hands, the greatness of the advantage came home to him, and a cruel smile tightened his loose lips. Slowly, step by step, he advanced, his chin sunk upon his chest, his eyes glaring from under the thick tangle of his brows, like fires through the brushwood. Nigel waited for him, his left hand forward, his knife down by his hip, his face grave, still, and watchful. Nearer and nearer yet, with stealthy step, and then with a bound and a cry of hatred and rage, Paul de la Fosse had sped his blow. It was well judged and well swung, but point would have been wiser than edge against that supple body and those active feet. Quick as a flash, Nigel had sprung inside the sweep of the blade, taking a flesh wound on his left forearm as he pressed it under the hilt. The next instant the cripple was on the ground, and Nigel's dagger was at his throat. "You dog," he whispered, "I have you at my mercy. Quick, ere I strike, for the last time, will you marry or no?" The crash of the fall and the sharp point upon his throat had cowed the man's spirit. He looked up with a white face, and the sweat gleamed upon his forehead. There was terror in his eyes.
"Nay, take a knife from me," he cried. "I cannot die like a calf in the shambles."
"Will you marry?"
"Yes, yes, I will wed her. After all, she is a good wench, and I might do worse. Let me up. Let me up, I tell you. I will marry her. What more would you have?"
Nigel stood above him with his foot upon the misshapen body. He had picked up his sword, and the point rested upon the cripple's breast. "Nay, you will bide where you are. If you are to live, and my conscience cries loud against it,
At least your wedding will be such as your sins have deserved. Lie there like the crushed worm that you are." Then he raised his voice. "Father Athanasius!" he cried. "What ho! Father Athanasius!" The old priest ran to the cry, and so did the Lady Mary. A strange sight it was that met them now in the circle of light: the frightened girl, half unconscious upon the table, the prostrate cripple, and Nigel with foot and sword upon his body. "Your book, father," cried Nigel. "I know not if what we do is good or ill, but we must wed them, for there is no way out." But the girl by the table had given a great cry, and she was clinging and sobbing with her arms round her sister's neck. "Oh, Mary, I thank the Virgin that you have come. I thank the Virgin that it is not too late. What did he say? He said that he was a de la Fosse, and that he would not be married at the sword point. My heart went out to him when he said it. But I, am I not a butts-thorn, and shall it be said that I would marry a man who could be led to the altar with a knife at his throat? No, no, I see him as he is. I know him now, the mean spirit, the lying tongue. Can I not read it in his eyes that he has indeed deceived me, that he would have left me, as you say that he has left others? Take me home, Mary, my sister, for you have plucked me back this night from the very mouth of hell." And so it was that the Master of Shalford, livid and brooding, was left with his wine at his lonely table, while the golden beauty of Cosford, hot with shame and anger, her fair face wet with tears, passed out safe from the house of infamy into the great calm and peace of the starry night. End of chapter 12.
Liberty's leave policy was tremendous. Having the ability to take 16 weeks off, fully paid to bond with my child, was an incredible experience.
At Liberty Mutual, you can find a career that supports you at every step, even baby steps. We offer up to 16 weeks parental leave for new moms and dads. And because not everyone's pathway to parenthood looks the same, we offer robust fertility, surrogacy, and adoption benefits too. Learn more at libertymutualcareers.com and pursue your tomorrow today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.